I think it's really important for people that are anticipating child one to be surrounded by people that have been there. And for people that are in relationship, married or otherwise, and just dealing with the things that are part of being in relationships, to have somebody say, this is a significant day. We've been married for 34 years. Anybody who's been married for more than a few months probably already knows that is actually quite an accomplishment to be married for a long time and have grown children and still be alive and in love and all of that. That's awesome. It's awesome. It's wonderful. And it's really lovely to me. You guys, it's no surprise if you've been part of this community any amount of time to know that I feel this way, but I love the sound of what's happening here, among other things. It's fantastic. It was a very odd morning for me this morning to see, and I said this to John and Andrea, that I think that's who I said it to. It's a bit of a blur already, but that there were all these kids here this morning when we started, and none of them were the kids that are usually here, which is kind of bizarre in the best way. Just really fantastic, and our kids are kind of arriving as well, and wow, how awesome is this? So we're improvising a fair bit, right? This is not a new thing in our community that we would be improvising a bit. It is, as it turns out, very consistent with what we're going to explore this morning. Today, as Marianne already said, is our AGM, our annual general meeting. We need another name for it, but that is sort of the legal name for it, and so we'll stick with that for now. But for any of you that have ever been, one of my kids said, I mean, they've grown up with a guy who works in churches, right? That's just their lot in life, and for good or for ill. So Davis, my oldest kid, says to me, well, I guess it was last time we were talking about this morning, and he said, so is this the kind of meeting where people are going to get up on chairs and yell at one another? Which is actually something that has happened at an AGM that I've been at in another context. And I said, you know, no. Why? He said, because that's a meeting I'd show up for. So I can't promise you that anyone's going to get up on any chairs and yell at anybody today. I think it's going to be a little more genial than that, but we're looking forward to it. We're in the terrain of the story of Moses this morning. And Moses, of course, one of those visible leader characters in the Bible, right? And so some of this is going to be about Moses' experience, obviously, because we're going to work from his story. But I don't want anybody to check out because you don't think you're a Big Al leader. Not the least of the reasons that I would say that is because, as we'll see going through the story, that even the thing that we think of when we think of leadership is up for grabs, is up for change, is up for evolution, is up for, in this context of this series, for a reboot. I'm going to review the story just briefly because there are some features about it that are going to be important for our consideration this morning. Moses, of course, is born a Hebrew baby. He's born at a time in the history of Egypt when the Egyptian pharaoh has, for all intents and purposes, forgotten the backstory and just doesn't remember that that these people were at one point favored by the pharaohs, and they've become enslaved over time. It's a curious thing. The harder they make them work, the more babies they have. There's a thesis in there somewhere, at least about health. Anyway, there's lots of babies being born to these Hebrews, and they're a hardy bunch. And the pharaoh is getting nervous about the threat that they pose to the empire. That if a neighboring country decided to invade and somehow won the loyalty of this nation of robust slaves, that they would turn the tide on the empire of Egypt. And that's a fearsome thing to the pharaoh. So in the interest of putting them down, hard work not having done the job, pharaoh turns to the elimination by murder of male children. There's a very cool gorilla story embedded in that point in the tale, and it has everything to do with the midwives. It's not what we're going to talk about today, but they launch their own little insurrection, the midwives do, and in the interest of having these babies not be either delivered to death or delivered and then killed. They're just saying these Hebrew women, man, they just pop them out. It's all done by the time we get there. So sorry, Pharaoh, like we can't help you all the time with this. And it's not what's happening at all necessarily, but there's this whole little insurrection that goes on inside the story. It's very fascinating. Moses, of course, survives being born. He's hidden by his ingenious mother. Eventually becomes a little too noisy to hide, and mom builds an ark out of weeds and sets him adrift. Okay. I'm not going to major on this, but it's an emotional checkpoint. You've heard me say this so many times. I'm not going to stop saying it because I believe it's not just a truism, but a thing that actually has a great deal to do with how we live the life of belief. If we switch off our imaginations, it's over. Because God's in the room, but not like we're in the room. God's in the story, but not like we're in the story. And if we don't use our imaginations, we're not going to make the connection. Imagination is the word itself, just means the ability to see what isn't right in front of you. Imagination. Making an image, right? Imagine, just for a moment, and we'll go on. Imagine putting your baby in whatever that thing was that got made and shoving them off from shore. That's a very important point in the story. Because that, in a lot of ways, is the emotional experience of change. Of engaging with something, the end result of which is not clear. That's a pretty egregious, high-profile, emotionally rending example. But it's the same thing we do whenever we set ourselves adrift. Whenever we kind of launch out into something new, dangerous, and unknown. It's an important point in the story. Anyway, she sets him adrift. And of course he's found by the princess, and who knows, maybe he's just a little cherub. Anyway, she just decides to take him home when he's old enough that he's not a bother. He ends up being raised by his birth mother and eventually taken into the palace of the Pharaoh, where he is trained as a prince of the realm. Among the other things that that means about Moses is that Moses would have been educated by the best of the best. Moses would have been inculcated with the highest level of what we would now call best practice in business, in leadership, in military strategizing and leadership, in all things having to do with empire. He would have been trained by people at the peak of their game. So he is a product of the dominant theories of everything in the realm. There's a curious subtext about these early formative years in the story of Moses that the writer makes sure we don't miss. Moses' formation, somebody that's a better student of history than me, I didn't take the time to look this up, feel free to correct me, but I believe it's generally credited to Marx as saying that if you give me a child until they're four, you know, basically they're mine, I've educated them. And their ways of belief will always kind of be those. Moses, of course, in those earliest years of his life, is raised by a Hebrew mother who tells him a very different story than the story of the empire. And that kind of comes back later in the story. So we just need to remember that that's percolating underneath the surface. And the story now, Moses has grown up, takes a curious turn. He's now a young prince of Egypt. Sees a Hebrew slave being abused by an Egyptian slave master. I couldn't help but wonder when I hit this point in the story, what must that slave master have been doing to get Moses' attention? This is a culture of enslavement. So whatever's happening here is egregious. Whatever Moses sees, it must have been pretty horrendous. Anyway, he sees this abuse happening and gets involved, and long story short, kills the Egyptian slave master, buries his body in the sand. When a subsequent event, very shortly after that, makes it plain to Moses that the story of his murder of the Egyptian has leaked out, at least among the Hebrew people, he realizes that if it's leaked there, it's liable to make it back to the Pharaoh. It's liable to make it back to the court, and he runs for his life. I don't know how many of you guys saw, this was years ago now, 1998, Prince of Egypt, the animated feature of this story. But there's a scene in that film that I can't get out of my head, which is Moses fleeing the court of Pharaoh, fleeing Egypt across the desert. And as he flees, at one point, I think he falls down and some of his jewelry falls in the sand, one of his bracelets, this gold, these things that represent all the things that are about power and influence and affluence, falls in the sand. And as he flees, more and more of the trappings of that influence and affluence fall away and are just buried by the drifting sand. Just washes over them. They're gone. It's filmmaker's way, of course, of saying this part of the story is over. Going on to a different part of the story. It's interesting that that stripping away in the story of Moses turns out not to be some kind of punishment from God, but rather it turns out to be an essential element in a really profound change process that Moses goes through. One that is way bigger than just a change in understanding within the single character of Moses. It becomes a representative change process, and that's kind of how we're going to engage with it a little bit this morning. You got to think about this in terms of these time blocks, right? So Moses has this childhood, young adult life at the heart of empire. And then, having blown it, if you will, and having had to flee that, he spends 40 years herding sheep in what the Bible, in most of our English translations, so genteelly calls the backside of the desert. Every once in a while I wish I was a translator. You know, anyway, the backside of the desert indeed. The experiences of which include bushes that talk, and this long echo of childhood stories about people being freed from oppression by God. And all these things are kind of milling around inside Moses for decades. What Moses is experiencing in those decades is not, and this is where, as I said in my weekly email, this is where my metaphor failed utterly. It's not like a reboot. It's not even... I suggested maybe a better metaphor was a system crash. The more I thought about it, I just thought there's no mechanical metaphor that actually reaches this. This is more like, on mild days, this is more like a snake shedding its skin. This is more like a caterpillar becoming a butterfly. Oh, that's such a fluffy romantic image in our culture. I hesitate to use it, except that it's such a profound metamorphosis. This is a level of change that is crazy. Deep, profound change. And so when God comes and asks Moses to lead the Hebrew people out of slavery in Egypt, Moses turns down the job. And it's a really curious thing that Moses' objections are all about the little I. I can't do this, I can't do that, I'm not this, I'm not that. And when God responds to Moses' objections that his eye is not up to the job by saying, "You're actually doing this for me. I'm the guy in this story, not you." Moses basically says to God, "And so who the hell are you that Pharaoh should listen to you?" He says, "If I'm not the eye that's up for this, what makes you the eye that's up for this?" The way the text gives it to us in the story is pretty confrontational. It's pretty blunt. And God responds, and this is this classic Eastern kind of thing, right, that happens. I mean, theologically, we can make a great deal out of this, and legitimately, but God, this is where God says to Moses, if I was Moses, I'd be going, "Thank you very much," at the end of this, but God says to Moses, "I am that I am. Tell him I am sent you." Great. I'll try that. And that's God's answer. When Moses says, "Who are you that Pharaoh should listen?" God says, "I am." Play by a different set of rules. And Moses is supposed to work with that. In the end, of course, he does, right? In the end, of course, he says, yes, he goes. But he doesn't go to do this in the way that he started out thinking that he should. Some of the shifts in his understanding are easy to see in the story, right? He doesn't go as a sophisticate. He doesn't go as a prince of the realm. He goes as somebody that is humbled by the reality of God. Somebody that's willing to obey a call that he can't even really claim to understand. And certainly that he doesn't feel qualified for. That's a pretty big shift. He doesn't go with the kind of arrogance that is fueled by his taking matters into his own hands the way that he did in Egypt. He goes as somebody in awe of God. When you think about Moses' moment at the burning bush, which I've talked about before as being akin to jazz improvisation, there's a melody there that never changes, but all the things around it are constantly changing. When Moses has this moment with God in the desert with this talking bush thing, one of the visible shifts that happens inside of that narrative is the shift of where he locates the center of his worship. And we remember the phrase, if we know the story, take off your shoes, you're standing on holy ground. Moses did not set out that day into the world with the understanding that the place that he was, the world in which he walked and herded sheep, the ascent of the desert, was a holy place. He didn't carry that understanding into the day. Had he, God would have had to say, you know what, Moses, you missed it. This is holy, right here. Where you are, where I am, is with you. That's holy ground. So, walk with God. The backside of the desert, Moses, is holy ground. Put it back into the vernacular. The ass end of your life and mine, the bits that are awful, the bits that are not the things that we talk about, holy ground. Why? Because this God who defines himself with this ridiculously encompassing phrase of I am is there. How do we walk in the world? How do we walk in the things of our life that are just crap, that are really hard, defy explanation? Well, the story of Moses suggests, among other things, that awe is not a bad way to walk into the world. The expectation that this being is present is not a bad way to walk into the world. Seems that as part of Moses' transformation, he's had to get over the idea, among other things, that he is God. Now think about it for a minute. It's not that strange. I'm not trying to make some point about how we think about ourselves necessarily. There's actual history to this. Moses grew up as a prince of Egypt. The pharaohs were deities in the Egyptian understanding of the universe. They were gods. Pharaoh was the deity. So Moses, as a prince of the realm, is in the queue to be God. That's the cosmology under which he's trained. Should it be any surprise that a human being that thinks that they're a god would take matters into their own hands to the degree that they would attempt to solve a problem of justice by direct violence of the kind that takes another human life? Not really. That's the prerogative of a god. Right? And Moses has to actually get out of that whole paradigm before he can do something about the oppressed people. He has to shed that entire skin, that entire belief that he is all that, before he can actually be effective in doing anything about the enormous oppression of the Hebrew people. That's a huge shift. It's a kind of shift that took not just the death of a career, but actually the death of another human being before the merit of that idea could be challenged, before Moses would actually seriously reconsider it. And then on the heels of that, as long as we're talking about change experiences and change process, it doesn't just take a cataclysmic experience to knock Moses loose from that idea. It takes 40 years of processing. Where? On the backside of the desert. In difficult terrain. And then Moses comes to the Pharaoh, as the story goes. He doesn't come alone, which I think is a super interesting part of the story as well. One of his objections, of course, is I can't talk. And so God sends him his brother Aaron, who apparently can talk and can articulate these difficult things, and removes the objection. Now get this, you guys. Pay attention. Removes the objection of the leader as an isolated individual by providing that leader with the community of leadership. Moses doesn't actually go as this kind of lone wolf hero on behalf of God at all. We were talking about this in the car the other day. We've kind of been doing this thing with our kids, our older two kids at this point, where we're kind of looking back over the careers of people that are now very established, well-regarded actors. And kind of asking ourselves as parents the question, what films could we choose that would introduce our children to these people whose craft is so established and, in many cases, pretty awesome? And in some cases, just has profile. They may not even be actors who've made films that we regard as being all that important, but they have had a real impact on the culture. So an example of an actor that might be defined that way, I don't mean to be unkind to anyone in their absence, but is Sylvester Stallone, who certainly had an impact on the culture. He's given us some archetypes. One of those archetypes is Rambo. So we're talking about the archetype of Rambo as we're driving to wherever we were driving the other day. And how that has its roots in the idea of the Western hero, the lone cowboy who rides in, shoots the bad guys, rides out. If there is romance in those stories, it's in passing. And the woman is fortunate if she survives at all. So that's a whole type, right? Moses does not act in this story in that type at all. But when Moses says to God, I can't do this, he's actually talking out of a type that's not that different than that. I can't do this. I'm not a broad-shouldered, narrow-hip, hat-pulled-down, low, gunslinging hero. I'm not going to actually ride in and do this. I can't. To which God responds with community. You're right. You can't. And that is a very important part of Moses' shift. Here's another part that's not so visible in the story, but that's super important. Moses is processing the shift of his understanding of the nature of God. It's visible culturally in the trappings of this story. The writer of our text doesn't make much of it, so we have to pay some attention to history. Again, Moses is educated as an Egyptian prince. So, pharaonic deity aside, he is also educated in a world that is full of gods. Lots and lots of gods. And they're a capricious, curious bunch, the Egyptian gods. But there's lots of them. Moses, as a prince of the realm, would be queued up to be one of them. So when Moses leaves that entire realm of thought and goes off to the desert to process for 40 years, to get involved in change, seriously. One of the things that he is processing is what it's like to live in a world that maybe doesn't have that sort of God in it. Those sorts of gods, rather, in it. And so when God comes to Moses as part of this call and says, I want you to go and deal with the oppression of my people, and Moses asks God to define God's self, God's answer, I am, is actually vague and Eastern and bizarre to us. It's also a profound shift in the understanding of the nature of God. God is saying to Moses, and it's a very important checkpoint in the history of our belief these days, God is saying to Moses at that point in the story, you know that whole understanding you have of God as a multitude of beings? Well, time to reconsider. Time to shift. God says to Moses in the story, is one. The idea that God is one, if we operate in the Christian realm at all, is rather cherished. As you can see, if you're paying attention to the symbols in our space, we take the idea of a Trinitarian God very seriously. But frankly, the idea that God is three yet one is a pretty young idea. And it's not actually, if you chase it down theologically, it's not actually seriously defended as the last word in the nature of God at all, but rather as our best attempt to put some handles on the mystery of God as best we can. Super important. Lots of reasons to believe that this is a very defensible and substantial understanding of the nature of God, but it's not the last word. This is the process that Moses is in. He's moving from a world where God is many to a world where God is one. That's an enormous shift. Huge process. It's an interesting thing that all of those trajectories, all of those different changes that I've been trying to describe, they all have something in common. What they all have in common is enormous change. So just for fun, And because I believe that the stories of our sacred text are actually meant to be carried into our time and our imagination in ways that I would describe as true, I want to lay what I've been talking about against a contemporary change model. The model that I'm going to use, partly just because I think the graphic is not that hard to grasp and to work with, is called the Satyr change model. Some of you will have seen this. It's a well-known model developed by an American psychotherapist named Virginia Satir, who was at the zenith of her work, late 70s, early 80s. Someone who's regarded in the realm of therapy as the mother of family therapy. And she created this change process model. So basically, this is a psychological model that she's developed through her own clinical studies. And what happened to that model after she died was that a lot of change management and organizational gurus kind of picked this up as a legitimate representation of change in organizations as well as in persons. So here's a little bit of history. Basically, the graphic of the model looks like this. It's interesting that the goal of the model, as it shows up in the model, is competence. So you can kind of see the residue of its application to business here. But anyway, so growing competence is the axis on the left for you, and the bottom axis, of course, is process over time. We start with however things are, status quo in the model, right? And then something happens, outside influence, an event, new idea, could be any number of things, but something impacts the status quo. And then the change process, as this model would have it, is that initially that influence, which impacts the status quo, is met with resistance. The process of resistance descends into chaos. That as we resist this new idea or this change, we experience chaos. If we remain addicted to the status quo or to the chaos that we experience, the curve just keeps going down in terms of the competency response, right? You can see the dotted line going off the bottom, the chaos addiction curve, as it's called in the model. We just basically, our competencies suffer and suffer and suffer at the hands of the chaos until they just go into serious decline and things fly apart. Or we can kind of go into the crucible of change, which is the bottom of the curve where the chaos is the highest, and we can begin to learn new ideas, and we'll look at a little different shape of that in a moment, and begin to integrate those ideas into a new status quo. Doesn't sound that appealing, depending on what you believe about change, but there you go. So the next version of this model, of course, starts on what is your left, that new status quo, and happens again, right? If we stay addicted to the status quo, so we resist change, but we don't become addicted to the chaos of change, then what happens in the model is that our competency curve just kind of slowly falls off because we refuse to respond to whatever the event is. We refuse to engage with the chaos of change. And we just basically stay where we are. But in the model, like in many experiences in life, staying where we are actually is to be in decline. Let's just see the next one of these. Right. So, well, I've got these in the wrong order. The one I actually want, so just scroll ahead a little bit here. That one. Thank you. A little different version, but I want us to think about this version in terms of Moses' experience for Simone. So same thing, in this case the change impact is called a foreign element. Chaos is a little different experience. Chaos kind of comes and goes a little bit more. But what's happening in this model, in the season of chaos, is that the individual or the organization is working. They are trying to educate themselves about this new idea, and they're experimenting with it. I was looking at this model last night, and I was thinking about this morning, and then I came in this morning to what we came into, which is trying to find power from every part of the building, trying to figure out what we're going to do with a bunch of new families that are here this morning, trying to figure out how we plug in everything for Super Sunday in this space, which we've never done before, without blowing every breaker in the building. And by the way, there are almost no breakers in the building. They're all fuses, and you can't tell which one's blown. The whole panel's down when you blow one, so you don't want to blow any. And so, what? And who's providing mentorship for this exactly? Anyway. So there's the chaos, right? What's the new event? The new event is new space. The new event is new people in community. The new event is more kids. The new event is Super Sunday. The new event is, right? So we got a whole bunch of things. All of a sudden we're thrown into one version or other of chaos in which we learn and we experiment. And that happens in large ways and it happens in small ways. Where we're headed in this model out of that is to... This is a rather optimistic model, but aren't all models a little bit of a distillation to a moment of insight, right? The light bulb goes on, we go, aha, that's what we need to do. We need to rewire the entire building. And so we just have this moment of insight, after which we begin the practice of implementing all of that, and everything gets better, and we get the new status quo where the lights stay on and the heat stays on, and we can plug in as many crock pots as we want, and all the children are well behaved, and we go happier than when we came. You see, new status quo. Now, I'm being facetious. But there you go. Okay, now Brent, the one that we just looked at before. This is somebody's, I kind of like this one. This is somebody's version of the human experience, not the organizational experience, of the same model. Okay? This has got all kinds of feeling language in it. So this is interesting, because when we think about the process of change, a lot of times why we bail or why we resist or why we become addicted to chaos has to do with the way it feels to be tossed into a change process. Can I cope? So this is the status quo. I can't keep going like this. Things can't continue. Oh, look, something's going to change. What impact is this going to have? How's it going to affect me? Oh, this is way more challenging than I thought. I kind of, the guy's out on this, kind of out on this, walking the plank. Kind of out there ready to just take a dive. And all these different emotions. I'm so happy that there's change. Oh, I'm afraid now. What's going to happen? This threatens me. I feel guilty because I'm not engaging with this. I'm not sure what to make of it. I'm struggling with depression now. I can't respond to this adequately. Having questions of identity. I'm out of here. I'm disillusioned. I'm going to go. And then the ability to eventually start to imagine a different future and to move forward into that future. This can work and it can be good. I like this particular version of the drawing simply because it inserted the feelings into the experience. The other one just felt a little too clinical. Especially when I thought about our community, when I thought about the things we've been talking about, when I think about what it means to be people who are willing to actually reconsider their ideas about God and about faith and about life, and to say, how could this change? This can only be one way. This can only be the status quo. What if the change process, if we think about it, is instigated by Moses' crisis as an Egyptian prince, when he kills the guy for abusing the Hebrew slave? What if we think about that event as catalytic for an unfolding process of continued change that actually never stops in the life of the people of God? Moses has this experience, it changes him. Moses gets tossed into a 40-year period of chaos and uproar while he processes all of this, so he can move from the idea of God as many to the idea of God as one. And then still wrestling with that idea and wondering what leadership looks like, because he's still working with the Egyptian it's all about me idea. God challenges that and says, no, actually, what if actually dealing with oppression is not about the individual, the big L leader? What if dealing with oppression is actually about the community and their response? And Moses has to process that. The people of Israel, the Hebrew people, actually leave Egypt. They spend 40 years wandering around in the desert. I don't have time to really unpack this morning, but among the other things you can find in the archaeology of that time and that place in the world is the symbols, the change in the symbols that the Hebrew people would have left Egypt with to the symbols that they end up with after 40 years. That if you read through the stories, you actually, and you learn the history of the Egyptian gods, you can actually watch the Hebrew people taking the symbols of Egypt's worship, and turning them literally, in some cases, in the case of the snake, turning them upside down. So God, it takes a long time to change big ideas. It takes the Hebrew people 40 years of wandering around in the desert to shift their paradigm. And then, when they move into their new land, the process doesn't stop at all. This idea of new creation, this idea of people being made new by God, this idea that starts in Genesis, just keeps right on flowing through the story. And when Christ comes into the story, Christ basically is saying the same thing. You know that paradigm you've been working with all this time, people? I'm here to change it. And then if that's not enough, this is the way that the text ends. Revelation. I never teach from Revelation, for all sorts of good reasons. But here we go. Revelation 21:5. We know this text if we grew up in Christendom. He who was seated on the throne said, I am making everything new. And then he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. I am making everything new. And Revelation goes on to paint this picture of heaven coming to earth. It's very curious that the dimensions of heaven in Revelation are almost exactly the same as the dimensions of the known Greek world. It's the writer's way of saying, heaven's coming, and it's the whole story. It's the world. Heaven is coming here. Paradigm shift. All right. What if our gig? What if our gig is the table, as this community, is to find everyday ways of acting out what it's like to be a people who are constantly being called into the crucible of change. I think we've got one more slide here, if I'm not mistaken, right? This was somebody's... Maybe we don't. And if we don't, that's fine. There we go. This is somebody's version of this drawing that included color, which I think is very significant. And so the crucible has this, like, you know, bonfire going in it, right? The change process doesn't feel good. Chaos doesn't feel good. That's why the drawing with all the emotions on it was so important. The process of reconsidering belief, the process of reconsidering the engagement of belief in life, that's not a party. That's hard work. That's not going to necessarily feel fantastic. It might actually feel an awful lot. And we use a word like crucible in a process like this on purpose. That might feel an awful lot like that. I didn't pick the drawing because of any imaginary connection to images of hell. So just so you know, it's just crucible. It's just heat. But what an interesting thought. What if this is normative? What if being a person who takes seriously the idea that God is in the world and God has something to say to us and that there is a call in our lives to respond to what God has to say to us that changes us and that is actually meant to change us in ways that then changes the world. What if that is a worthwhile, entertainable idea? What would that mean? What would that mean to us as a community? Well, among other things, I think it would mean that we shouldn't be surprised by change. The change is actually not the enemy of faith at all. The change is actually a normal part of the life of faith. A normal part of life is God. The reconsideration of what we believe is perhaps no more and no less than us continuing to press on in the same direction that the story's been going the whole way. Why else would the text end by saying it's going to keep being new? Why else would our sacred text kick the end right out of the story and say this story just keeps on going in the direction it's been going? I think that's worth wrestling with. And that's all I'm going to say about that. We're going to talk a little bit about hands-on, if you will, versions of change in our AGM as part of that process. And that's partly why I wanted to talk about this story this morning. Because change, I believe, is normal. Change, I believe, is good. Change, I believe, can take us deeper than we were into the heart of God, both as individuals and as a community and as a world. But we have to be willing to entertain the idea that change is good. The way that God is good. And that's a big idea. And it might take some time. And that's okay.